This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Simon Connolly.
And I'm Morgan Marion.
In our final interview of the season, Morgan sat down with the charismatic and enthusiastic Dr. Jenny Yant. Jenny is an expert in social insects. That's bugs like bees and wasps, who build nests and hives with a queen at the center.
So most of my research is on bumblebees and wasps, stinging insects, and a lot of my research before coming to Otago was on social wasps in general. And I just think they're the most fascinating, beautiful creatures, and I just love them.
What brought you to the social wasp? Have you always had an interest in social wasp, or?
Yeah, you know, At first I just wanted to study animals in the wild, and ultimately I just did a project. I discovered that unlike most animals, bees actually let me get really close to them while they're doing whatever it is they're doing. They could care less that I'm standing next to them, taking their photo, watching them. And I thought, I could do this. This is what I want my life to be. I want to study things that let me study them while they're just living their life, you know? And then I got an opportunity to work on wasps, and I thought, wasps, bees, they're like the same thing, right? They're not. They're not close to the same thing. But as a result, I ended up in this wasp lab and got these opportunities to excavate these colonies. I put them in these observation hives. So honeybee colonies for years have been studied in observation hives, where you can watch them as they interact with each other, as they dance, as they recruit. But nobody's really peeked inside of a lot of other social insect colonies. So here I am with this observation hive that I helped design. And because of the fact that wasps build horizontal combs, honeybees build vertical combs. So honeybees build vertical combs that are in parallel, so you can put them in an observation hive, but almost everything else builds these horizontal combs, which meant for an observation hive, I have to have the box horizontal and then the glass on the bottom, because that's where all the good stuff happens. And then I would just get a little pillow and I'd lay down underneath the observation hive and just watch as these individuals were interacting with each other. I set up these little experiments, having them bring back food to deliver to one another. All of those data are still on the videotapes, which can no longer be played with any of the current types of styles that we would play video, but maybe someday. And I do still have the boxes, and the hope is that we can still look at and do some of these in-nest observations, because what people mostly see is the stuff happening outside, the foragers. Mm-hmm. And there's so much happening in the nest.
Yeah. Can you talk about what it is to be social? What exactly is socialness in insects?
Yeah. So in social insects, they have three basic defining qualities. They have a queen and workers, so reproductive division of labor. Somebody in the nest is the primary egg layer. Others are doing something else. You have cooperative brood care. That means everybody's taking care of the young. And then you have also this overlap of generation, which means that in any given time, there's always these different age groups that are coming out of the nest. So that means at any given time, the colony is just comprised of a primary egg layer, non-reproductive individuals who are doing everything else. But sometimes what they do tends to change as they age, as they get older. Younger individuals might stay inside of the nest and take and feed the young, feed the larvae. The older individuals are more likely to start cleaning out the nest or go off to forage. And all of these tasks are getting done simultaneously. So this is one of the reasons why social insects are so ecologically successful, because at any given time, they're all doing all of the things that need to be done.
They've really taken, it takes a village to raise
the
children to the next level. They're really kind of...
Exactly. Yeah, they're all
so successful.
They're all working together on it. And you can even go up to the next level and consider a lot of these colonies, like the great big Vespula colonies, or the social wasp colonies underground, the honeybees, a lot of ant species, you can consider them super organisms, where just like, you know, in an organism where we have some parts of our body that's devoted to reproduction, other parts, other cells in our body devoted to just the somatic cells to function, to be fingers and eyes, so too does the social insect colony have individuals devoted to reproduction, and then the workers or the somatic cells of the mm-hmm. colony devoted to all of the functional tasks to make that colony function as a whole unit. And so some of the work that my lab does is, instead of just taking the individuals and observing them, we look at the behavior of the whole colony. And so the questions that we ask are things like, well, if in different environments or at different population densities mm. or different temperatures, do we see changes in whole colony level behavior? And my favorite whole colony level behavior is, especially in wasps, is aggression, because it's so easy to quantify. You just go up to the colony, you blow inside of the colony. They use that carbon dioxide as a signal that there might be a mammalian predator nearby. Mm. And then they get all ruffled up, and then they just leave the nest and they just look for something to attack. And so we put out these little plastic black plates in the field and put a little microphone in there. And then they just go ping, 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 ping. Now, if I'm not standing far enough away, they're also doing that towards the veil on my suit and other things. The camera gets attacked quite as well.
But so you're saying that different hives will have different levels of aggression?
Yeah.
How is that kind of, is it based on the queen's kind of decisions?
So I think that there's a genetic component to it. And so that's one of the areas of research that we're starting to dig into a little bit more, is looking at, you know, the within colony differences among individuals mm-hmm. versus the between. Because when we looked at all of these other different factors, we looked at temperature, humidity, we looked at the size of the nest, thinking, okay, well, bigger nests should be more aggressive. That's usually what we say.
Why?
Exactly. And so one of the reasons that bigger nests or nests with more workers might be more aggressive is because a more aggressive nest might be more successful at hunting, might be more, you know, better able to defend against anything trying to get into the nest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based on a whole lot of assumptions. That's based on the assumption that defense against a predator correlates with predatory aggression mm-hmm. or predatory, you know, behavior, or correlates with just, you know, cleaning or nest guarding behavior. And so those are all different areas that we can still look into because we don't know. But I can tell you that the number of foragers coming in and out of the nest doesn't predict how aggressive it will be. And the size of the nest itself doesn't predict it, nor does the amount of brood that they're defending. There's something inherently different between colonies.
So nothing predicts aggression?
None of the factors that I've looked at. So we're just scratching the surface on that one.
In the way that hives kind of get set up, there's queens can be ousted, or is that quite similar to honeybees, where certain queens can get kicked out after a while, or if they're sick or something like that?
That's a good question. And so there's a lot of misconception about this. So I'm going to walk through it for you.
Perfect.
In honeybees, they have a queen. And when the colony itself, the queen cannot survive on her own,
mm-hmm.
and the colony will not persist without the queen, because the workers, while they may be able to lay unfertilized eggs, which will develop into males, they themselves cannot mate. They will never be able to lay fertilized female offspring. What that means is that without a queen, the colony will die. But the colony is set up in a way where they're regularly having to replace that queen because of the scenario. The swarm doesn't survive without the queen. The queen doesn't survive without the swarm. So periodically, you'll hear of honeybees swarming, and that often just means the colony is splitting itself into half. The old queen goes off with the half of the workers, and the new queens that emerge battle it out to the death, and one of them remains behind as, like, the new queen. She'll leave the nest, mate, and then she'll come back, and she's the new queen of the hive. But that's specific to honeybees because of the type of life cycle that they have. Something like a bumblebee, on the other hand, the queen, the queens emerge in late autumn. They leave the nest, they mate, they go find a place to hibernate. And then over the winter, they just chill out. And in the spring, they start the nest all by themselves. Now, so that means that they have to lay all the eggs, build all the nest, forage for all the food for all the developing offspring. The first workers that emerge are going to be quite small, which is why you'll see in the spring, you'll see the great big bumblebees all over. And then it just seems like they just all disappeared. And that's because the new bumblebees that are coming out are really tiny. Mm-hmm. And the big ones are now staying in the nest because they don't have to leave the nest anymore. And then as the season progresses, the colony builds up more and more mm-hmm. food. The workers start to develop and get a little bit bigger and bigger. And then you get to the end of the cycle where they produce these huge queens who go off and mate. So the queens tend to live about a year. Each of the workers lives for maybe a couple months. And that same life cycle is true for the social ground nesting wasps, as well as the Polistes paper wasps that mm-hmm. live under eaves, where they have a single solitary queen that finds that nest. And so that's why, again, same thing with wasps. In the spring, you'll see the great, great big ones. And then eventually it looks like they've all disappeared. And then eventually, like right now, it's like they just spontaneously erupted and exploded in the population. Where did all these wasps come from? Plague of wasps. You see them all over the media. But they've just been hiding in the shadows.
It's just actually those queens have just been slowly building up.
Yeah, the colonies have been getting bigger and bigger. Yeah. They've been going off, doing their work. They've been foraging in the grasses for soft-bodied insects to bring back to the nest. They've been foraging on old fruits and stuff to bring carbohydrates back to the nest. Towards the end of the year, and these social wasps, these big wasps, especially when they get really big, what happens is once the brood is all gone, once the larvae that they're feeding is gone, they no longer have to go forage for other insects to feed the nest. Now they just need to survive. The queen has died. Mm-hmm. New queens have emerged, but they're going to go off and mate and they're going to hibernate. So all these workers, it just kind of turns into this anarchy state. The workers start to compete with each other. The dominant ones are the ones that usually get to lay eggs, but they don't really, it doesn't really sort itself out that nicely because everybody starts laying eggs. So you see cells with like 4 to 10 eggs laid in it because it's just, everything's gone crazy. They fight with each other. Some will still go off and forage. Sometimes they just get lost. But that's when you start to see them show up at your picnics. That's when you start to, because there's all of these wasps just kind of flying around looking for sugar to keep them going. And they smell your food and it smells mm-hmm. amazing and they want to share. So unless it's like a bottle of beer where they're going to get trapped inside and then I have to dump half of my beer out for them to like get out, I'm usually a big fan of sharing, just sitting back, being calm,
yeah.
Let them take a little food, let them go away.
I've heard of like caterers literally throwing a piece of meat yep. somewhere on the side elsewhere just so that they've got something to feed on and they can go towards that and just forget about the rest of the food.
My mom does that. So she sells fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
On the street.
She'll give like a sacrificial...
Yeah, she'll take a melon and cut it in half and she'll be like, okay, this is the melon for the wasps. This is the melon for the people. And sometimes that works.
I kind of love that. It's like an offering to yeah. nature, you know? Like,
yeah.
Here's our piece, you get your piece.
They do sort of have a little bit of recruitment in the nest, not quite the level of honeybees.
Mm.
But you may end up seeing a buildup of individuals at that. You got to keep that stocked, well stocked.
Can we talk back about dominance and aggression? Because are other social insects also aggressive? And like, are ants quite aggressive? Or is it really those social wasps that really show that aggression and dominance?
So this is a really important point. Aggression means a lot of things in the study of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about aggression, we're talking about wasps wanting to sting us, wanting to harm us. And I would argue that they don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing is they're responding to a stimulus or a cue that triggered something that said, the nest is in trouble. I have to go. Now I'm on the warpath to save it. That's a form of aggression. It's a defensive behavior. There's another type of aggression of And that happens in honeybees, bumblebees, that happens in all social insects, and they all do it to varying degrees. And everybody, when you get the social insect scientists together, has, you know, a story about, this is what I think is the most aggressive. Oh, let me tell you about when this colony got mad at me. They're all going to do it. I think bumblebees, though, are probably the worst at being aggressive to defend against their nest from, like, a mammal.
So they're not very aggressive? Is that what
you're
saying?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, we do get colonies where I get stung a lot, but I deserve most of those because I'm sticking my hands in their nest with a forceps and I'm pulling them out by their leg to take them and stuff, and they don't like that. So, and then they get out and they're like, and then they go right at my face. I'm not wearing a bee veil because they're usually not very aggressive. But what they do, unlike most social insects, if you disturb them in any way, the honeybees, wasps, they will usually fly out of the nest and attack. Bumblebees have this other behavior, which is they stay in the nest and they just start buzzing.
They're like growling, yeah. You know, like, yeah.
It sounds really menacing. It's really scary. But I actually did a study during my PhD where I, like, you know, did different types levels of disturbance to the nest, expecting to quantify, you know, the differences in colonies based on how many individuals were leaving the nest. Nobody ever left the nest, no matter what type of stimulus I put on there.
Did their buzzing ever, like, change in level?
Yeah, so it had more to do with how active they were inside of the nest, how much movement they were doing inside of the nest, and whether that activity stayed high after the disturbance or how quickly it went down. Yeah, so it's really very different what they would call this defensive behavior. Now, the other type of aggression you were referring to is dominance behavior, and that's more commonly seen within the colony. And even then, it's kind of hard for me to call that aggression because dominance in most animal groups is usually a series of displays, like a series of displays. As soon as you start to have this physical interaction and engagement with another individual, you risk harming yourself. So it usually escalates from just like a stare down, some tapping. You'll see mounting behavior where we'll climb on top of another one. You'll see, like, you know how when dogs show submission, they kind of roll on their back and show their belly?
Yeah.
Wasps will do the same thing. where the submissive will, subordinate will show a little belly. But the thing is a lot of wasps, and when they do this, and the same thing happens with bees and stuff too, there's a point at which these dominance contests happen, and they happen very quickly. So two foundresses who have never seen each other before get together on a nest, they do a series of displays, and then within, you know, a couple minutes, maybe 10 minutes, the dominance hierarchy is sorted and they never fight. Now, the first time I started working with Polistes wasps, I was thinking, this is cool, I'm going to see fighting all the time. No. They work it out. And then it's just this, they're very calm at working with each other, and everybody has their rank.
How do they work it out? Do they assess each other based on size, or?
It's a great question. There's usually an age component. There's different things. So, and I wrote a whole review on this too. So, and I just gave the lecture on it, so I should be fresh on in my memory. There is different factors. So it could be, you could be the one who started the nest and another one who joins will be more likely to be the subordinate. Mm-hmm. So the order that you join the nest, the age, whether or not you engaged with those individuals before you hibernated. So they call this like a play behavior, where they see these like interactions, these display interactions among pre-hibernating foundresses.
It's all actually quite nice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you think of fighting between these insects, I'm thinking like battle royale.
Yeah,
like,
I was
like,
too.
To the death, they're hurting each other. Yeah. But actually, they're being quite diplomatic about it all.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In, there's a species, Polistes dominula, who have these different facial patterns. And basically, they don't have to fight at all. They just know the hierarchy based on the facial pattern that they emerge with from a pupa. There's others where the facial patterns might change, and there's as they you know, rank up in dominance, and there's others where they just have different facial patterns, and so individuals recognize everybody in the colony and recognize their rank. And oftentimes when that most dominant individual leaves the nest, everybody just kind of moves up the next rank. There's very little fighting.
That's so clean and nice.
Which is so frustrating when you want to see them fighting. So I thought when I started working with bumblebees, everything I had read said, as soon as you remove the queen, the bees go into this competition phase. Mm-hmm. And I thought, cool, now I'll see some cool, like, bumblebee fights, you know? And so the queen would die or the queen would get removed, and I was looking and I was waiting for some aggression, and just nothing happened. Eventually I would see these like weird little ticks and little quirky behaviors that they would do. And so there's definitely an effect of the queen leaving the nest. Then I was reading this paper that said, no, Bombus impatiens, that was the species I did for my PhD. They're not very aggressive. Bombus terrestris. Now they really have an aggressive competition phase.
Which is the species that we have here. Right?
That's the species we have here, and that's the species I work with. So now I was really excited. I was like, okay, this is it. Queens are going to die. I'm going to see some competition phase.
Here we go.
Nothing.
Ugh.
And I'm thinking what happens is, what other people had also suggested might be happening, is that just like the paper wasps, that competition phase happened, but it probably didn't happen while I was looking. Or the behaviors, the interactions, the aggressions were so minor and subtle that I didn't pick them up as aggressive behavior. Because what's also happening, keep in mind, is it's not only just these overt behavior patterns, but individuals, as they increase in dominant status, everything about their chemical profile is starting to change. Their internal hormones are changing, so their behavior is changing slightly. But also the scent that they're emitting, the pheromones they're emitting, is changing. And so if you are changing into a dominant egg-laying individual in a nest that has an active, healthy queen, you will get attacked, even though you didn't do anything wrong. It's just your body was changing in the nest. And so they'll attack you. They'll police that behavior.
Challenging the status quo. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. But if that queen is gone and you start to exude those
chemicals, welcome you with open arms.
Exactly. You may just end up getting into that rank easier. So there's all these, chemical, hormonal,
cues,
visual, behavioral cues that are all linked to these dominance hierarchies.
It's so interesting. Wow. Yeah. Do you think that these aggression and dominance profiles, these behaviors, would you call them personalities? Are they personalities of these insects?
So first of all, let's start off with the word personality, which I think is a perfect word for this. But there's a number of behavioral ecologists and psychologists that really hate the use of the term. So another way that you could use, we can define what we're trying to get at with personality is by either calling them behavioral phenotypes, behavioral types, or by calling them consistent individual differences.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go with the last one because I think it really kind of defines what we're getting at here. Because what we're looking for are individuals that are consistently more aggressive, consistently bolder, consistently more exploratory, consistently have higher cognition levels. We have all of these different axes of personality or behavioral types that we can look at. And the key here is to identify whether there are consistently differences among individuals, both over time as well as across different contexts. So when we think of consistency and aggression, are they aggressive towards a mammalian simulated predator as they are aggressive towards in a predatory setting, as they are aggressive towards, somebody infiltrating their nest, a bumblebee coming and trying to get into their nest or something like that. So, which we watched. And they didn't really seem to care. So the bumblebee was clearly lost. It was pretty funny. So looking at how these differences, and so what that means is that you're spending a lot of time, and then you have to get a little creative. Well, how do you quantify predator aggression? How do you quantify nest defense? All of these different things. And then the other fancy thing that you have to figure out is, once you find all of the nests that you want to work with, how do you convince the people who run the campus or the land to let you use those nests for longer than 10 days, So there's all kinds of little complications with trying to get this out. But what we did for our research was we started with a pilot study. That was a 2-day pilot study up in the Nelson, St. Arnaud region. And then I did a 10-day study here in Dunedin. And then my PhD student, Mateus, did like a 3-month study. So we have these different periods of time. We have at each place, we have about 10 colonies that we looked at. And we had the same method where we blew air into the nest, quantified the number of individuals hitting this target. We learned two things very quickly. There are two species in New Zealand, and one species was regularly attacking our target, and the other species did not care.
So the two species are Vespula germanica and Vespula vulgaris?
Correct. And germanica was attacking our target. Vulgaris was not. But here's the crazy thing. Vulgaris is everywhere.
That's the one that's the highest density around New Zealand.
Exactly. Yeah. So everything that we found up in the Nelson region, all Vespula vulgaris, generally very low aggression rates. A couple of them had some pretty good responses. Most of them very low. The botanic gardens here in Dunedin, all Vespula vulgaris, all very low attack rates at this target. Mosgiel, that's where I had my mixture of vulgaris and germanica. And germanica were regularly more aggressive than vulgaris. So I think that's really interesting. But also the fact that, you know, the distribution of these species, the fact that the less aggressive towards a mammalian disturbance species in New Zealand is now the most successful one, seemingly. Yeah. So I think it's really important for us to go through and actually quantify, is this distribution of these two different species still, equal? But I don't think it is because just from anecdotal trying to find them, we're having trouble finding germanica nests.
And so do you think this level of low aggression is actually contributing to their successfulness at 100%. Spreading and establishing in New Zealand?
Compared to
Germanica?
Yeah, so one of the conclusions that we drew from the study was that, you know, there can be two strategies involved to being successful. You can either be very aggressive and defend your nest, or you can stay hidden. And when you live in a country where the predator is going to do above and beyond just trying to stick their nose inside of the nest and eat you, they're going to try to actively kill you with poisons. The more you can keep that nest hidden and stay hidden, the more likely your colony is going to be to survive.
In our next episode, you'll be hearing more about Jenny unraveling the mysteries of wasps and their aggression in Aotearoa, New Zealand. You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Marion. You can find us at ScienceBugPod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by Free FM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. Catch you next time.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.